And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We start the weekly news review with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge, who joins us on the phone. Sherry, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice.
It's good to hear your voice, too. Always like having you in the studio. Obviously, now we can't do that, but I hope that you and your family are doing as well as possible right now.
We are adhering to all stay-at-home orders, and we're a little stir-crazy, but we are good.
I'm glad to hear that. So you cover Cincinnati City Hall, obviously, very regularly, and you know all the ins and outs of that operation. What are you seeing as a reporter, just in general, of the response from the city, both in the both in terms of the issues that they're facing and how the individuals are appearing to handle it?
Well, I have to say, I never thought that I would be covering City Hall from my kitchen table, nor did I think I would miss it this much.
I know the feeling.
You know, it's fascinating to see how it's going. I will say there is an order on where the public is not allowed into City Hall, but the press is still very much welcome. But they have made it very easy to cover remotely. And, you know, really with an eye on their own safety and the reporter's safety. You can go if you want, or, you know, there's conference calls, there's you can watch meetings online. It's a whole new world, but it has been, I have to say, very transparent and doable.
A lot of times when we have you on with some of our other colleagues in the news business, we're talking about maybe some, you know, if I'm just going to characterize it superficially, drama that might take place at City Hall, something that we'll talk about. But in this time, how is that playing out? Are you seeing more cordial relationships and better cooperation in the response to the COVID-19 pandemic at the city level?
Well, they've had very limited meetings. And this, the thing that has been the biggest eye-opener for me through all of this is how the city charter works, and it's highlighting this. The city manager is in charge of making all of these budget cuts decisions. And the mayor's been having press conferences, you know, and inviting people, maybe like the Free Store Food Bank's there one day. The health commissioner comes, you know, each one. So they're three times a week. But, you know, we're seeing this huge, you know, very problematic deficit with a lot of cuts and furloughs that are needed. But there hasn't been too much discussion about it because this is in the city manager's purview and he is making these decisions. And that's how the charter works. And so we haven't seen a lot of things yet flow through city council. I think that's coming, though, when we look at next year's budget with just this huge deficit of $81 million, it's looking like. And, you know, we get weekly updates basically at this point, and that number is not changing, and a very scary number at that.
In years past, when the city faces budget issues for other reasons, non-pandemic related reasons, we might hear pushback from public employee unions, whether they represent the police or the firefighters or other municipal workers or other organizations that feel slighted by proposed cuts in the budget. Are we hearing any of that from those external organizations?
A little bit. They haven't been too loud yet. There's been some pushback behind the scenes of like, well, you know, these are bargaining units and unions, and, you know, there needs to be some seniority list. But there is an understanding, I think. People need to stay at home, and there is a budget deficit. So I think there's some sort of understanding there. But again, I think they're going to be much more vocal when it comes, when a lot of these decisions are being made for the next fiscal year, which starts July 1st.
And we're talking with Sherry Coolidge, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter. Sherry, speaking of cuts, we know that a lot of staff, hundreds of positions through the city have been furloughed, and originally this was characterized as temporary. What are we hearing as that budget is crafted? This is budget season for municipal leadership so that they can be prepared for the new fiscal year, as you said, that begins on July 1. What are some of the difficult choices that the city manager and the council will be facing?
You know, the city manager, in the 2 weeks ago, there was a council meeting, week and a half ago, I guess. The city manager, you know, he hinted at what's happening, and I am hearing that these things are true. There are going to have to be layoffs. I am hearing, you know, there's always like, oh, well, you know, everyone's going to have to do it, and that never comes to fruition, like every department. But I think this time we really are going to see some police officers and maybe even some firefighters laid off, and it's very scary prospect when you look at the staffing levels.
And this is going to have lasting effects. This won't be just this fiscal year that they're preparing for with probably less revenue because the pandemic has taken a toll on business revenue. And whether it comes through payroll tax or other buckets of money that the city had grown accustomed to in what had previously been a pretty solid economy, are you getting any indications of what we might be looking at years from now, a couple years from now, farther out?
You know what? I don't know what the solution is. There's a couple problems here. First of all, every single year, God love the budget director, like that, this is what budget directors do. You know, there's always a paragraph in the budget, which is, you know, 200 or 400 pages. It's a huge, long document, which kind of warns, like, a lot of the city's revenues come from earnings tax. And, you know, that's really not a good idea to have all of your eggs in one basket, right? And everybody just glosses right over that paragraph and keeps on going. Because we have these amazing companies, Kroger, Procter & Gamble. But, you know, we saw the first shoe kind of dropped when we lost Macy's as their secondary headquarters. And they said that was going to be a big hit to the budget, but things were coming in great. And so didn't seem that bad. But then that was kind of like, maybe we shouldn't be relying on the earnings tax like we always have. I don't really know what the other options are. And that is up to the council to figure out. I mean, this council has a lot of tough tasks ahead of it. And I have said, you know, say what you want about this council. You like them, you don't like them. They do all have experience crafting budgets in several years at this point, for the most part. With David Mann, the budget and finance chairman, that's going to be super important as they try and figure this out, because you start to understand where all the money's hidden and where the money isn't now. And these are going to have, some things have to change. There was, you know, some hope that there was going to be a stimulus bill that kind of flowed to cities the size of Cincinnati, fairly large cities, still under the 500,000 people. And that did not happen in this last one. And I think that was a pretty crushing blow because they think they really thought that was going to happen. And even the money that's coming to the county, maybe like $142 million, that has to be for direct COVID-19 response, which quite frankly they do need, right? PPE, masks, you know, all of this additional health worker stuff. So that, and homeless, you know, helping them through all of this, that money is super important for that, but it cannot help the budgets over at the county or at the city.
And we're talking with Sharon Coolidge, City Hall reporter at Cincinnati Inquirer. City Councilman Chris Seelbach made a proposal, and I'm curious about where it stands. You reported this back on April 16th, so about 8 days ago. He said during a council meeting that while the budget was being discussed, that perhaps FC Cincinnati, our Major League Soccer team, should give back at least some of its nearly $33 million that the city contributed to the team's West End Stadium, which is currently under construction still outside our studios here in the West End. Is that moving forward, that proposal? Will that be discussed further?
You know, Chris Seelbach asked the city manager, you know, whether it would be possible to ask for that money back. And the answer kind of came back, yeah, you can. I don't think it's going to be any easy ask, and I'm not even sure he has support for it, but I do expect that still to come through on Wednesday and maybe even come to a vote on what council would like to see. And honestly, it would be like a request that the team return the money. And so they don't have to say yes. And while they haven't perhaps picked up the money yet, it was deemed for infrastructure underneath the stadium that would serve a lot of the West End. And, you know, that stadium's coming up out of the ground and that infrastructure, it's in. And so I feel like that money might be spent, but we'll see what happens.
You also wrote a story about another one of our major league teams, the Reds, and how their coaches and players are urging the Black community here to stay safe during COVID-19. Talk a little bit about what their message is.
You know, we have seen nationally and a little bit locally, those numbers are still locally still coming in. With the low testing, it's a little bit hard to tell still locally that COVID-19 is hitting the African-American community very hard. And the commissioners last Friday, I was, you know, pinch hitting over at the county last week for a little bit. And, you know, they put together a video, Victoria Parks and her staff, but really with the support of all the commissioners, with athletes trying to reach that community in a different way. than is normally, you know, maybe they're not reading, you know, mainstream things, but they wanted to reach young Black people and to tell them to stay safe. And so they kind of took this alternative route with this video, and we put that up to kind of share it. And, you know, that was an interesting way to get at it. They are thinking, they're looking at these numbers, and they're trying to do the best they can to keep people safe. And so this was just one way they were doing that.
You also had a very interesting story this week about SORTA, the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority. They were sued by a citizen who had been blocked on SORTA's Facebook page for a critical comment. And SORTA ended up unblocking him, as they say on Facebook, and apologizing. Give us a little bit of background on this case.
You know, these cases have come up from time to time, and I've actually written a couple myself that I forgot about, and I was like, oh, yeah. You know, government entities are not supposed, they're on Facebook and Twitter and public officials too. And, you know, people can be critical on social media. I don't know if you've noticed.
I've seen.
Right? You know, you got to have a thick skin, right? Like the Inquirer, maybe not like a public official, but you got to have a thick skin when you're posting your stories on our Facebook page and things like that. Like it's a forum for public comment. And the courts have really started coming down on that. Well, you know, SORTA is in the midst of, you know, a levy, but this is really just about, should the buses be free now? Should the buses be running? And they did a Facebook post about that, and it was a very controversial at the time of what SORTA was going to do to keep the bus drivers and people riding the bus safe. What's the best course of action? They make a post, and this Warren County man, who has been critical of SORTA, I have to say, over time, you know, posted a comment on their Facebook page, and he didn't think the buses should be running.
And this, you know, is Jordan Arnold.
And they blocked him.
It's a Mason, guy from Mason. His name is Jordan Arnold. He said in your article, quote, "They censored me because I spoke out against their dangerous policy, and it's not the government's job to decide which voices are heard." And so SORTA ended up apologizing for this.
They did, and they unblocked him, which is really what he was seeking. I think there's probably going to be lawyer's fees and such, but he went to the courts and he said, First Amendment, those are my rights, and to, you know, have a public voice. And when you're a reporter, like, you believe in that and you understand, like, you want to have, especially now, you cannot go to the meetings in public now. You know, there's different ways, like, you know, write a letter and, you know, it'll be taken into consideration. Public forums are very limited with the stay-at-home order, and so, you know, this is one way to do that, and he wanted to have his say.
In addition to covering City Hall, where you've spoken with many mayors over the years covering that beat, you and your colleague Jason Williams in your podcast, That's So Cincinnati, at the Inquirer, you spoke to a mayor who predates all of us in the media now, but is well known well beyond the Cincinnati area, Jerry Springer. He was on your program, and he had some comments.
Our podcast is called That's So Cincinnati. Who's more Cincinnati than Jerry Springer?
I'll let the listeners debate that. And he had some comments about President Trump and the daily press conferences that have gotten a lot of attention. Tell us what Mayor Springer told you.
You know, it's no secret that he is not a fan of the president. And he, you know, if he went there, he didn't have any kind words to say about the Florida governor either. He lives in Sarasota full time, comes back here a lot, keeps his hand, you know, in local politics a little bit. And he's appalled at, you know, what the president has been saying on these nightly briefings. And he was talking about whether they should be shown or not every night. And it was kind of interesting because he, you know, was really, he's media savvy and political savvy. And so he's looking at it through both lenses. He's like, of course, cover them, go cover it. But he doesn't think it should be shown each night. He feels like it's like fueling, you know, I think, some diverse opinions and not good for the country, he was talking about. And so he was like, don't show it. And so it was kind of like, the person who created the Jerry Springer show was kind of telling the network journalists not to show what has become a little bit of a sideshow in the evening.
So pick a side there. The podcast is called That's So Cincinnati, hosted by Sharon Coolidge and Jason Williams from The Inquirer. Sharon Coolidge is the City Hall reporter from The Cincinnati Inquirer. Sharon, I hope you stay safe, and thank you so much for spending some time. I'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Have a good afternoon, and I'll keep you on for the rest of the show.
I appreciate that. Thanks so much. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The weekly news review continues now with WKRC-TV Local 12 reporter James Pilcher. James, thanks for coming back on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Michael.
It's our pleasure to have you. Listen, Thomas Massie has been a pretty controversial member of Congress since taking office. He's from, I would say, the Ron Paul school of politics. He's also a big fan of Rand Paul, the Kentucky senator. But man, he took some heat from President Trump. So why don't you just set the story for us back to that point? What was Massie's position that angered the president?
Well, he had two positions. This was back when the first $2.2 trillion stimulus package was being approved that everybody wanted desperately to get the small business loans in place, expand unemployment, and include the stimulus checks for everyone. His point was, first of all, that they were rolling too much into one bill and that there was going to be a lot of pork in there and that, there needed to be more oversight. His second point it was that they needed to do it in person and that it shouldn't be just done by a conference vote and that they needed to get everybody's vote on the record. So he made a motion and he actually made everybody, and there were several people in Congress that actually left Washington, made them all come back and vote. So there was a lot of people saying, oh, he's just drawing attention to himself. And if you know Massie, you may agree or disagree with what he stands for or whatever, but, I get the sense that he's not doing this for his self-aggrandizement. He truly believes in what he's doing. Now, whether people agree with what he believes in is another question. Well, this whole thing blew up, and he became, like I said, he drew the ire of President Trump, who actually tweeted about him saying, you're only delaying it. You're not going to prevent it. He called him a third rate grandstander, to which Massie quipped, I thought I would be at least second rate.
and we should note that Thomas Massie likes to use the hashtag sassy with Massie. So he likes to try to be clever on Twitter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But he is a constitutional absolutist. So he wants to follow the letter of the law. You have to follow the rules and everything else. So that's what that was all about. So when that happened, all of a sudden, several members of Congress and several members of the GOP establishment started to say, hey, what about this guy, Todd McMurtry, a Covington lawyer who is running against him for the GOP nomination? So he started getting a huge amount of donations from the GOP establishment, including Liz Cheney from Wyoming, who's former Vice President Cheney's daughter. And she's the third highest ranking Republican in the House. The Jewish coalition, the Jewish Republican coalition gave a bunch of money to McMurtry. I think that stems from the fact that Massie doesn't want to give a lot of money to Israel. He's voted against giving money to Israel. So all that money started flowing in. And then over the weekend, somebody finally went back and looked at McMurtry's own tweets and found several that were questionable. He called himself a racist, saying he was a redneck racist. There were several that questioned whether people that were from other countries should be here because they didn't speak English. There were several that he's since deleted since all this attention came into play. And so when that all hit, the New York Times did a story about it over the weekend, and then The Hill, the congressional outlet, did a story about it, and Liz Cheney actually tweeted saying she wanted her donations back.
Okay, well, let's let people know who Todd McMurtry is, in case that name doesn't ring a bell. He is one of the attorneys representing Nicholas Sandman, the Covington Catholic student from that encounter on the Washington Mall back in January of 2019. That's how he sort of rose to at least a national profile and heightened local profile. And he decided to run against Congressman Massie with this message that Massie is not pro-Trump enough. So now what's happening with that narrative, as they both want to have the support of Trump's supporters in the 4th District?
Well, Massie has played cat and mouse with Trump ever since the president has been in office. I think Massie has his own core group of supporters outside our listening area, because as you know, the Northern Kentucky Congressional District stretches almost the entire length of the Ohio River for Kentucky, all the way from Louisville, all the way up only almost to Maysville. So it's very, you know, so his base is not what we consider Northern Kentucky, where Kent and Campbell and Boone counties. So McMurtry, I think, was coming at it like, oh, I can get that core more populous and beat him with the more establishment while appealing to Trump. Well, now it's like, you know, I even talked to people that, you know, a couple Democratic, the people on the Democrats who were running for this seat. All of a sudden, the money's flowing even into their coffers. They're saying they're getting to more donations because people are saying, well, I have to choose between these two people. So, you know, the effort to court Trump, I think, was McMurtry's strategy, but now he's not given any interviews on any of this. His lone statement to me was, "Oh, this is just intimidation by the national media." And oh, by the way, my opponent Massey doesn't support Trump or small business.
We should remind listeners that. Well, I was just going to say that we should remind listeners that Thomas Massey was a bit of an outsider in the 4th District. He was the judge executive in Lewis County, a more rural part of the 4th District outside of sort of the metro Northern Kentucky area. But that primary back in 2012 when the seat was opening up, and it's a solid Republican seat by most forecasts every cycle, it was split by the establishment Republicans in Northern Kentucky by Boone County Judge Executive Gary Moore and former state representative Alicia Webb Edgington. So the establishment Republicans were split, which paved the way for Massey, who's now been pretty safe. And so as someone who covers Northern Kentucky pretty frequently, like you do, you might hear rumblings on occasion from some people in the business or Republican leadership who say that maybe there could be a different Republican at some point representing that district. What are Republican Party leaders saying in Northern Kentucky about this scuffle?
They are staying completely out of it at this point. I tried to get four or five of them to talk to me earlier this week, and they were like, I'm not touching this with a 10-foot pole. Because on the one hand, you have a very unpopular Massey who really angered a lot of people with his stances on the stimulus. And he continues to. He even tweeted yesterday, I'm on the floor to vote. Where are my colleagues? I know where I'm at. Where's everybody else when the new $500 billion package was approved yesterday? So, you know, he continues to poke the bear on that end. And then you've got McMurtry over here who has these questionable statements in the past, who hasn't come out and explained them or defend them or denounce them. So, yeah, I mean, and McMurtry, after it was almost like, you know, McMurtry, after what Massey did the last time, was McMurtry was seen as the establishment candidate who had a possible possible chance to unseat him. Well, that's now it's all up in the air. And so, you know, so nobody, you know, and now it's almost like, okay, what's Massey going to do next? And someone's like, hold my beer here. You know, who's going to do what next? A little bit. But it really was fascinating to get. And, I mean, Massey, you know, to his credit, went on camera to talk about a lot of it, and he defends everything. He's been accused of being a racist in the past, but, you know, the things he tweeted out were taken out of context. So, you know, it's just fascinating to watch anything political. And this day is a little bit of a distraction, I think, and it was a fun story to do.
Kentucky's primary is June 23rd. It was moved from May due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we learned today that it will be by mail, of course. And we're talking with Local 12 WKRC-TV reporter James Pilcher. I've got about 90 seconds left. I want to hit two more things with you very quickly. You covered another local congressman, Steve Shabbat, Republican from the 1st District here in Cincinnati. He says more stimulus is coming, and it could be good news for local governments. So what can you tell us about that in about 30 seconds?
I talked to both he and Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, and they're both very much on board with another round of stimulus to help prop up local governments, which obviously are getting hammered with the lack of tax revenue coming in from sales tax, earnings tax, property, all those things. So, and they're saying we need, you know, the local governments are telling me, I'm doing a story about this today, actually. They're saying, you know, we're going to need this influx of money to keep the roads paved, the police paid, the firemen. So this is, and it's created a debate with others in Congress, including Mitch McConnell, who says, "Hey, states should be able to go bankrupt." So it's a philosophical conversation, but a lot of people are saying, "Hey, you know, that's the next step."
And you also covered the shutdown of basically festival season at Catholic parishes. And goodness knows there's a lot of those around here, and it's a big part of our culture. But because of this pandemic and the social distancing, a lot of them aren't happening. What does this mean? The season without cake wheels, what is it going to do to these parishes?
Well, you know, and I did actually did a huge takeout on it about 10 years ago about how sophisticated and business-like these events have become. For many of these parishes, it's upwards of 5 to 10% of their annual revenue. And then you throw in on top of that that they don't have bingo and that they don't have the collection plate. And these parishes, you know, some of them have a rainy day fund, some of them don't. And it's going to be interesting to see which ones survive coming out of this financially, and whether or not the dioceses on either side of the river are going to have to look at consolidation possibly over the long run.
Well, we'll continue to follow that. James Pilcher is a reporter with WKRC-TV. James, look forward to talking to you again soon. Stay safe out there.
Absolutely. You too, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. That was WKRC reporter James Pilcher. And now we are joined on the phone by a pair of WVXU reporters. We have Ambriel Crutchfield on the line. Ambriel, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for taking some time to join us remotely. And we also have with us Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Michael. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So glad you could both be with us. Miss you guys. Can't see you guys in the studio anymore. And I do hope you're doing well. And we'll look forward to when we can reconnect in person. But as usual, both of you had some very fine stories this week, and we'll talk about some of those now. Ambriel, you took a look at the difference in reaction to different public gatherings amid this COVID-19 pandemic. It was a very interesting story. And we're basically talking about that street party that got a lot of national attention online and over the Rhine, ultimately led to some charges, some of which were dropped, but also the recent protest at state houses, particularly the one in Columbus. So what did you find? Why do we view these events differently, both in court and in our conversations?
Yeah, so what was really interesting is that we do see that public officials, whether it's President Donald Trump, have condoned the anti-lockdown protest in certain ways, whether it's by not condemning it or just flat out saying we support it, we should be opening government back up or opening businesses and everything back up, versus when we look at the Over the Rhine party, the man that was videotaping it has a felony charge that's pending against him currently. And so with a mixed response, both by public officials and by bystanders, I reached out to some sociologists at Miami University just to get an understanding of how does location, race, and class play a role in how we interpret these events differently.
So who are these professors and what do they tell us?
Yeah, so I spoke to Rodney Coates and Stephen Lipman, and they both said, yes, definitely, race, class, and location play a role. And when marginalized communities, groups gather in urban neighborhoods, it's seen as a threat to the status quo. And also just the way that news outlets discuss and frame these events can grant legitimacy to something being a party versus being seen as a protest.
You asked a very interesting question to these professors. You asked how the stay-at-home orders could allow us to reevaluate our futures. What was their response?
Yeah, so you know, during this time, we've had a lot of time to kind of think about like our own families, how systems are working, who they're working for, and what do our essential workers look like. Lipman says, you know, that does provide us like a little bit moment to kind of reflect on those things, but they're not, in the past, they haven't been sustainable change. Whether we look at an example of 9/11, we were united during that time. And then after, you know, people split, whether it's their party wise or just their ideologies.
We're also joined by WVXU reporter Ann Thompson, who has some stories we want to talk about as well. And Ann, you have one that's relatively concerning, I suppose, because it's about scientists worrying about the next pandemic. We're not even through this one yet. What did you find in your reporting on this?
Well, it is kind of eye-opening that because of our travels into lands that we hadn't been in the past, we have exposed ourselves to certain things, and this could be, hopefully not, but the first of many.
And so does it appear that there's a better sense of urgency about being prepared for what might happen next after some criticism about America's preparation for this one?
Well, I think if we do certain things right or learn from our mistakes in the current pandemic, that could help us in future ones. For example, one of the scientists was saying we really need to be better at doing things rapidly, determining what virus we're dealing with, and then quickly, in a matter of just days, figuring out a treatment, and then quicker than we're doing it now, a vaccine. There needs to be rapid testing, and that's what we're kind of missing at this point.
That's right. And so you did report, citing ABC, that a rapid diagnostic blood test for the presence of COVID-19 antibodies might be available next month. Did the scientists have anything to say about how important that could be?
Well, they didn't really address that. This was a panel that was put on by the Council of Foreign Relations. And so they discussed just how the method, they didn't really talk about anything specific with any drugs or rapid testing in this, but they were just saying that there really needs to be, in terms of methodology, some changes made.
We're also joined by WVXU reporter Ambriel Crutchfield. Ambriel, you returned to coverage of Cincinnati Public Schools. They will be out of session learning remotely for the remainder of the school year, and some changes could be coming as the way students are graded. And there's also some concerns about funding. Let's start with the grading situation. What is changing or what could change?
Yeah, so currently they're going to move to where students can get a pass or incomplete. So whatever the student's score was in the third quarter, say I got a B minus, I have the potential to work up to an A plus, but I can't go lower than the B minus that I've already earned. And so they went to that model just to, one, acknowledge students that do that are able to complete their assignments, but also to recognize that not all of their students have access to tech resources that they need to be able to keep up with the work.
And there was also some concern expressed, like so many other organizations and entities, that funding could be a problem. What's the main concern for the largest district in our region?
Yeah, so they're looking at, the state is looking at reducing the per pupil funding. So each student at CPS may be getting less money to support them, along with, you know, some people are out of work right now and unable to pay their mortgages, which also impact, you know, them not being able to pay their property taxes. So that those are all things that could impact CPS's, where they're actually really expecting it to impact the funding that they get in, on top of already the Ohio State freeze that they've been experiencing, where despite the growth they keep experiencing year after school year, they're not getting more money from the state. So all those things combined, they're trying to look at ways on how to move forward. They don't think it'll be something that'll impact them like this coming up school year, but they are expecting this to come up in a few more years.
WVXU reporter Ann Thompson is also with us. And Ann, you took a look at Cincinnati Children's Hospital and a doctor there who is spearheading an effort to get COVID-19 resources to other hospitals who need it. What'd you find?
Yeah, so it makes kind of sense that from what we've seen and heard, children really aren't the main target of COVID-19. So a doctor there at Children's Hospital is trying to figure out, well, how can pediatric facilities then be opened up or lend their resources so as to treat adult patients? And so she kind of put the word out there and created a website. And that was ramped up with a doctor who was in Boston. And they together then just kind of contacted other doctors and ultimately helped hospitals in New York, some of the hardest hit areas, and Detroit and New Orleans, where they actually did have to have children's hospitals taking adult patients. That wasn't really the case here, or it doesn't appear necessary. But in terms of just making sure these doctors and hospitals get the resources they need, and just to strengthen relationships.
And you're talking about Dr. Ashley Jenkins.
Ashley Jenkins and Leah Ratner are the two doctors. Ashley Jenkins is the one here at Cincinnati Children's.
Okay, and the name of the organization, it's got an acronym that's fun, POPCORN.
Yeah, it's POPCORN. It's Pediatric Overflow Planning Contingency Response Network.
And that's at popcornnetwork.org. Before I let you all go, Ambriel, talk a little bit about the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office and the domestic violence program that it's launched.
Yes. Yeah, so Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters launched this week a crimes of violence against women and children unit. They'll help law enforcement 24/7 when cases come up as they work with victims, just to be sure that people are not re-victimized as they keep having it, you know, in the past, they've had to re-explain their story over and over, so having the same team with them will allow them to not be re-traumatized. Earlier this month, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, 60% drop in child abuse and neglect cases, but it wasn't because that they believe that they're any less. It's just, you know, people are not going to school or work, and so those sightings are just not happening as much as they would be.
And you can read more about all these stories and other stories from the WVXU news team at WVXU.org. WVXU reporters Ann Thompson and Ambriel Crutchfield, thanks so much for taking some time on Friday to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, bald eagles making a comeback in Ohio. And we'll take a look up at the skies with Dean Regas from the Cincinnati Observatory and the Looking Up podcast. The weekly news review continues. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Support comes from Everything But the House. You can find or sell everything uncommon in this curated and carefully authenticated online marketplace for secondhand goods, including art, jewelry, antiques, collectibles, and more. Sales close daily on thousands of items at Everything But the House. You can learn more about home service or consignment solutions at ebth.com.
Things are quieter than usual here in our newsroom, but not because there's any less news to cover. Our staff is dispersed. Many of us are working from home to bring you Morning Edition, so we understand that loneliness and social isolation are very real concerns. But we will be right here to keep you informed and to keep you company. We're not going anywhere. Stay connected with Morning Edition from NPR News.
On 91.7 WVXU, with host Marianne Zalesnik.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, and as luck would have it after that promo, we're joined now, possibly from a closet, by WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana.
Hi, I'm closet adjacent at the moment.
Okay, well, I'm glad you've got a little bit more space, and thanks again for coming on the show. Obviously, our news team is joining us remotely because of social distancing standards, only a few of us here in the building. But you had a great story this week. Apparently, Ohio's bald eagle population is soaring. What did you find?
Thanks for repeating my pun. I'm pretty proud of that one. the Ohio Department of Natural Resources did a nest census. So, you know, Ohioans aren't the only ones that should be filling out their census forms. They went out in March and February and had citizen scientists. So, you know, people around the state helped and spotted bald eagle nests. And then the ODNR went out and confirmed them all. They found 707 confirmed bald eagle nests across Ohio. That is a 151% increase from the last nest census in 2012. They just found 281 then. So our national icon is, you know, on the rise here in Ohio. And back in just 1979, so 40 years ago, there were only 4 nesting pairs of bald eagles in Ohio.
Well, what do they credit for the rise?
Well, you know, of course, there's a lot of people would say, you know, some of the pesticides and things that we aren't using are there. There was also, they were protected for a very long time. They've only just recently, in the last couple decades, come off of protected lists. And there are still some federal laws that protect eagles and gold eagles. And, you know, just also maybe the water's a little cleaner and they're attracted, of course, you know, the largest place in Ohio that you'll find them is up along Lake Erie. And because there's a great source of water there, lots of ground for them to hunt and, you know, build nests.
Yeah, it looks like the most populous county is Ottawa County with 90 nests. And just for perspective, there were 3 nests identified in Hamilton County. It looks like 8 in Butler County, which is the most in southwest Ohio. The other ones are in the lower single digits. But yeah, other high numbers, 50 in Sandusky County up north there, 32 in Erie, 18 in Lucas, where Toledo is. So that appears to be where they are. Well, that's a fun story and good news. Did you get to see any bald eagles while you were out?
County. I did not. However, our coworker in engineering, Bill Dean, who lives out east of Cincinnati, sent in a picture because he spotted some out by him. So,
wow.
Yeah. He and people have been telling us where they've seen them a lot. They like to be along bodies of water. So we know that there are some along the Great Miami, especially up toward Hamilton and out at East Fork and Caesar Creek. So,
well, you also had a story this week about quarantine adults with disabilities and something called Brighter Day Boxes. Tell us what those are.
Yeah, so the group in town, LAD, that supports adults with disabilities, helps them, you know, live independently or live in, say, group home situations. They realized that a lot of their clients, you know, are going to be sequestered for a lot longer probably than other people, because they're just at higher risk for leaving their home. So they put together these Brighter Days boxes. They've got books and comics and games and activities and, you know, things that people can do in their homes. And they started distributing those around Easter time so that they're, you know, people can have something to do, keep occupied. And as they're still trying to reach all of the people that they support, now they're adding in things, gardening tools, because again, since they won't be able to be leaving their homes once these stay-at-home orders get lifted, they want to give them activities they can do outside, but still in their, you know, in their yards.
Very cool. And you also found some entertainment for yourself while you're locked away in your closet doing your reporting. I guess you did some stories about the choirs moving online to provide entertainment. What are you finding there?
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, we brought you the story of some local choirs that were doing these virtual performances where, you know, you usually starts out with one person singing by themselves, and then, you know, all of a sudden your screen multiplies and you have a whole choir of everybody singing from their homes. And so we looked for some local groups that were doing this, and there were 2 that were putting these together, and the Cincinnati Youth Choir dropped their video this week, and they do a song called One Voice by Ruth Moody, which is, it's really pretty poignant. You might be chopping onions when you watch it. You know, it talks about this is the sound of one voice, but then that one voice obviously becomes almost 80 kids. It's pretty fantastic. I highly recommend it. You can find it on our website. And the other group that is working on one is the Cincinnati Young Professionals Choir. I might have just butchered their name a little bit. But they're getting ready to drop the Young Professional Choral Collective. They're going to drop theirs in a couple of weeks. So be on the lookout for that.
And you wrote that it takes a lot of editing for these videos out of the Cincinnati Youth Choir, for example.
Yeah. So they had, they're the ones that had told me that they were expecting 100 hours to put the... took to edit the videos. It's not just something that you can throw together or do very easily at all. And that's once they send, you know, all the kids record themselves and send it in. Then someone, you know, has to take all that time to put it together. So, and a lot of these kids had to learn the song from scratch, younger singers that hadn't sung it yet. So they had to watch videos of their instructors online, teaching them their parts. So it's really pretty an amazing feat for young kids.
And we are all adjusting. And yeah, so it's at WVXU.org?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's where you can find all of Tana Weingartner's reporting. Tana, thanks so much for being with us. Yes. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
And now for a reason to look up. Dean Regas is the host of the WVXU podcast, co-host of that podcast, Looking Up. And he's also an astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory. He joins us now on the phone. Dean, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right. So nice to hear you. I want to start with something that appears to have already happened before we talk about the anniversary of the Hubble telescope. It looks like we may have missed, if we hadn't already looked at it by now, the LIRID meteor shower? LIRID?
Yeah, LIRID meteor shower, or LIRID, either one. That's goes by either name, but the Lyrid meteor shower, yeah, it was something happens every April. Every April 22nd is usually the peak of it, where we run into these the stream of old comet material, and they come across as shooting stars in your sky. And so, yeah, we heard it was nice, clear skies for Wednesday morning to watch it. We heard some people saw maybe about 10 an hour or something like that. So it wasn't like a laser light show or anything like that. It was a pretty cool show. But we're still encouraging people to get outside and look at the stars. And you might catch a couple late Lyrid meteors that are still streaking by. And at least, you know, get out and see some stars, too.
Well, if people wanted to take their chance to see the Lyrid meteor shower tonight in case one of them flies on by, what's the best time and best direction? What do you do when you go out?
Well, of course, we can't always make it convenient for everybody. The best time to view is from 2 to 5 a.m.
Perfect.
You know, prime time for you, Mike. I mean, that's like when you're up. But, you know, you can catch some stray ones earlier. Usually 11:30 p.m. to midnight is where you can kind of start with this. But you might have a better chance waking up before dawn and seeing it about 5 o'clock. But, you know, what we've got is we got a lot to look at tonight in the sky. We got Venus blazing away in the western sky. Looks like a UFO. People have been calling about that. And then we have three planets in the morning just before dawn with Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter lined up.
So there's a lot of good things to look up and see. I guess the observatory's been, its attendance obviously impacted like everywhere else because of the social distancing requirements. How are things at the observatory in general?
Well, so, yeah, we're officially closed like everybody else and really waiting to reopen and show people the stars. It's been, you know, everything's been kind of plugging along behind the scenes. We have a lot of virtual classes. We have a lot of resources for folks that are stuck at home, too. We have it on our website, CincinnatiObservatory.org. And I've been giving a lot of virtual presentations lately, too, to schools and other groups. And then I'm doing a live webcast today at 3 o'clock for the Hubble Telescope's 30th birthday. So we're getting the word out to a lot of people. And, you know, when people are at home, we want them to stay safe. But one of the best entertainments, I think, is to get outside with your friends and family and whoever you're quarantined with and do some stargazing.
And the Hubble telescope is 30 years old now. And for those of us who aren't that knowledgeable, what's significant about the Hubble telescope?
Well, I mean, this is the my second favorite telescope, second to the Cincinnati Observatory telescope. Of course, I got to say that. You know, but, this is the telescope that launched into space in 1990. So April 24th, 1990, it launched up in the back of the space shuttle. And they let it go up into space, and this has been the telescope that circled Earth, you know, every 90 minutes or so for 30 years, and it really changed the game of how we do astronomy. It being above the clouds, being above the atmosphere, it could take longer exposure photographs, it could see the farthest in space that we've ever seen, and just the pictures that it's brought back. If you see any space pictures, chances are it's the Hubble telescope that took it. It's like our astro photo album of our generation.
So if people go to CincinnatiObservatory.org to find information about the Hubble telescope course, what happens in the special class you're offering, the free online class?
Yeah. So this is we're doing this through Google Meet, and it's a stream, live stream. So you can it goes from 3 to 3:30. And we have a link that you just click on when you go to our website, CincinnatiObservatory.org. You can find the link there, and you just join the webcast at the stream at 3 o'clock today, and I'll be showing you some of the greatest hits, the greatest pictures Hubble has ever taken, and a little bit of behind the scenes and some of the drama when it went up there. It wasn't working so good, and they had to do a repair mission. They had to send astronauts up there to repair it in orbit, which is an unbelievable feat of unbelievable achievement. And then it still keeps going. Every year, it still lives on. I'm always amazed to live that long up in space. It's been amazing.
Hubble Space Telescope has been social distancing for 30 years, and you can learn about it today at the Cincinnati Observatory website, CincinnatiObservatory.org. Online class, free, taught by Dean Regas, the astronomer and co-host of the Looking Up podcast here at WVXU. Dean, you said the Hubble Telescope is your second favorite telescope. The Cincinnati Observatory is your first. What is your fifth favorite telescope?
Fifth favorite telescope, I'm partial to the one at the Lowell Observatory. That's a pretty good one. You know, I could rank my whole top 10 very easily, that's for sure. But the part that's getting to me with this is that we've had so many clear nights, too. And every time I see the stars out there and I think, oh, man, if only the observatory is open, we could share this with people. But we're itching to get back to it. And as soon as we can, we hope to have everybody over because we've got some great stuff this summer with the planets coming back.
Well, we'll have you back to talk about it when times are better and we can gather again. Dean Regas, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Keep looking up, everybody.
We'll catch you next time.